Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The official start of summer is still a month away, and yet communities across the country are already experiencing extreme heat. A heat dome over Mexico is contributing to extreme weather in southern Gulf states, where temperatures are topping 100 degrees. In Texas, hundreds of thousands of people remained without power at the start of the week after a devastating thunderstorm last Thursday. Health officials are warning that individuals without access to air conditioning may be at risk of heat-related illnesses. Extreme heat has been the deadliest weather phenomenon over the last 30 years, according to the National Weather Service, and the climate crisis is making it worse. But few protections exist for workers who have no choice but to endure high temperatures. To make things worse, last June, Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott signed a bill that prevents cities and counties from passing regulations that are stricter than state regulations. It also overturns local rules, such as ordinances in Austin and Dallas that mandate rest breaks for construction workers, according to Texas Public Radio. Workers will not get mandatory rest breaks as temperatures exceed 100 degrees. And that is exactly what is happening in places like Laredo, expected to hit 107 on Friday, 108 on Saturday, and 109 on Sunday, which all would be record highs. The Washington Post reports that in Houston, the heat risk level, which can range from 0 to 4, is forecast to climb level 3 by the weekend. Cities including San Antonio and Brownsville are expected to reach level 4. Florida's Governor Ron DeSantis also signed a similar law in April, which bans local governments from requiring heat and water breaks for outdoor workers. He also signed a law to remove most references to climate change from state law. This is happening as Florida residents also face record-breaking temperatures. Miami's heat index last Saturday hit 112 degrees, the highest on record for the month of May. Key West hit 115 on that same day. But there are currently no federal heat-related laws in place to protect workers. So what explains all of this? How will workers protect themselves without any government regulations? Joining us are three guests. Carly Hyland is assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Carly Hyland's work focuses on mitigating the health impacts of interconnected climate intensified exposures among agricultural and food systems workers. Professor Hyland completed her postdoc in Idaho, where she examined farm workers' experiences with heat and climate change. Hi, Professor Hyland. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Jean Kwong is a reporter with Cal Matters, where she covers labor politics and California's government. Jean Kwong has been following efforts to enact indoor heat protections for workers. Hi, Jean. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, it's Jeannie, and I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
Oh, sorry about that. Hi, Jeannie. Thank you. We're also joined by Gray Moran, a reporter with Civil Eats, where they write about public health, climate change, and environmental justice. Gray has recently covered grassroots efforts to implement heat protections for workers in Florida, one of the states where lawmakers have prohibited cities and counties from passing their own regulations. Hi, Gray. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Happy to be here.
Great to have all of you. Thank you so much. Carly, Professor Hyland, let's start off with you. I have to say, this is just pretty enraging. I mean, I've been reading all of these articles about what is happening to workers across the country. And to think that Republican governors like Greg Abbott and Ron DeSantis are basically superseding city laws to say, okay, Dallas, you can implement these rest breaks, which Dallas did in 2015, but sorry, not anymore. And there's so many stories about people who desperately need these, I mean, what is a 10-minute break in 112-degree heat, right? But these workers desperately need these breaks. So first off, let's talk about the federal aspect of all this. Why don't we have any federal protections at a time when this kind of heat is happening even before summer starts?
Yeah, thank you so much. I think you raised a lot of good points there, you know, including that it's often already the most vulnerable or susceptible populations that are disproportionately impacted by these exposures. And we know with climate change, this is going to continue to get worse. It gets hotter earlier in the year. We have hotter days, longer heat waves. It's hotter at night. And many individuals in these groups, you know, don't go home to air conditioning. But to your question about federal heat standards, there has been an effort to have a federal heat standard. And unfortunately, you know, it's been in conversations for a number of years now. And at the federal level, it's just taking a long time to go through all of the different processes with federal OSHA for us to get a heat standard for workers.
Can we talk about why that's the case? I mean, who's really pushing for this and who is standing in the way of federal heat regulations?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of different groups pushing for this, you know, including various community groups representing workers. I think one really important note is that right now we are still only talking about federal standards for outdoor workers. And I'd be curious to hear from the others on the call about, you know, other efforts for indoor heat standards, which is also extraordinarily important. I think a lot of the delay is just the you know, kind of honestly, the bureaucratic processes and how long it takes to develop regulations like this that are enforceable. But I do want to note, you know, so I've done some work both in Idaho and California, which have very different approaches to regulation. So California was one of the very first states with regulations for outdoor heat for outdoor workers, and Idaho does not have such, you know, state level regulations, and in the absence of a federal regulation, probably never will. And I do caution people sometimes from kind of thinking that a federal heat standard is going to be the perfect solution, because I think that there are still gaps in enforcement with those regulations at times. And so I think sometimes people look at states like California as being, you know, a state that has it all figured out and is perfectly protecting workers. And I think even here, we're still seeing a lot of, you know, issues and lack of enforcement and still a lot of need among workers. But certainly at least having a regulation, or, you know, not preventing the development of a health protective regulation is a step in the right direction. But I just kind of don't want people to think that that is, you know, if we get a federal regulation, that that's it, that we've done everything we need to do to protect workers, because I still think that there's a lot of work to be done.
This is a really important point, and we'll talk about this later in the show, because if you're talking about farm workers, for example, especially those who are undocumented, how will any of this be enforced, especially if workers are afraid to stand up for their rights? So there's a lot of layers to that. I'm glad you brought that up. We did find a piece at Grist from January. As summers grow ever hotter, OSHA appears ready to protect workers. Reporter Katie Myers reports that over the past 15 years, OSHA received 3 petitions to implement a federal heat standard. The rulemaking process finally began in 2021, but could stall if President Biden loses the election. And they quoted Jeannie Economos, who works with the Farm Workers Association of Florida, who said, OSHA has to be balanced, and there's a lot of pressure on OSHA to do something, so we have to just wait and see. It could take 3 to 8 years to get a final rule. According to this piece, many in the construction and agriculture industries are opposed to any federal regulations. And, I mean, the fact of the matter is, Professor Hyland, they have a lot of power in Congress.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And I think one of the interesting things is, you know, you pointed out earlier that really workload is the thing that is most impacting people's likelihood to experience heat stress. And so if you're able to decrease workload primarily through, you know, increased breaks, both increased frequency and duration of breaks, that you significantly reduce the likelihood of people experiencing heat stress. And I think that the big concern there is that it will impact productivity and the economics. And there's actually some very, very compelling evidence that increasing the frequency and duration of breaks for workers such as agricultural workers actually increases their productivity when they come back to work. And so ultimately, I would love this conversation to be, you know, centered pretty solely around human health. I would love for that to be a strong enough argument to have these regulations and enforcements. But at the end of the day, you know, economics are extraordinarily important. And I think that this evidence that, you know, there can be mutually beneficial solutions that both protect farm worker health as well as increase productivity, I think is an interesting approach to take.
That is Carly Hyland, assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Gray Moran is a reporter with Civil Eats. And Gray, in April, you wrote a piece about Florida banning farm worker heat protections. Can you tell us more about Governor DeSantis signing this bill? You spoke with Eric Nicholson, a farm worker advocate and the former vice president of the United Farm Workers, who said it is morally repulsive and it will kill farm workers. I have accompanied the families of too many farm workers who have needlessly died due to heat stress.
Yeah. Law HB 433, it blocks municipalities within Florida from passing their own measures to safeguard outdoor workers from the heat. And these are really basic measures. This could include providing water to workers, providing breaks, providing shade. It's pretty small what workers are asking for. But these are also, as you said, potentially life-saving measures that make a real significant difference, and are kind of the baseline of what is necessary. And as Carly mentioned, there's a lot more that would need to be done to really substantially protect against heat illness. But I think it's definitely very alarming that Florida is going after local measures, to protect this, and kind of extending the reach of the state government to prohibit local mandates.
Gray, you did an extensive piece about this. So given that DeSantis, I mean, the other question I would like to ask, if you know the answer to this, did any Democrats support this bill in Florida to ban local jurisdictions from protecting workers from heat exposure?
I am not aware of that question. I know that the text of the law mentions that that local mandates, quote, ignore the individual responsibility of an employee to follow relevant guidelines. So I think the intention of this law is essentially to foist the responsibility of protecting against heat illness entirely onto farm workers and construction workers and other outdoor workers. But I think it's important to note that the capacity that farm workers have to actually protect themselves is highly limited, just because of the conditions of their job, where they're required to work at a very fast pace. And, you know, what workers can do for themselves is essentially just wear clothing and recognize the signs of heat illness. But the real meaningful protections like water breaks and mandated shade is something that does need to be a requirement.
Well, so it seems like when you just think about this practically, you have to hope that you have a decent employer who allows basic breaks. You point out that the Fair Food Program, which is a groundbreaking partnership between retailers, farmers, and farm workers, they've implemented the strongest legally binding heat protocols in the nation on Florida's farms. And they bypass the state's Republican-controlled legislature. And so they say that shade on fields should be mandated. There should be water with electrolytes and rest breaks every 2 hours. And so it seems like this is a no-brainer for any employer who, first of all, wants to treat their employees with basic respect, but also wants to make sure that their employers are not fainting on the job or in worst case scenario, dying. So is that where we are right now in states like Florida? You just have to hope that your employer is going to implement these basic protocols?
Yeah, exactly. And that's an incredibly successful program. It's just on few farms. And unfortunately, it's expanding. It's expanding to other states and industries as well. It's known as a worker-driven responsibility model because those requirements were actually drafted in part by farm workers. And it's enforced by an outside body that also operates a hotline and performs audits on the farms. So it's a really thorough accountability mechanism. But yeah, as you said, it only applies to the farms that are participating in that program or an employer that decides they want to offer this. But I will say that farmers are very frequently saying that there's a farm worker labor shortage, that they can't find enough workers. Actually, last year, after Florida passed a law targeting undocumented immigrants, there is an exodus of farm workers from the state. And so I think when thinking about a farm worker labor shortage, I think one of the clear solutions is to make the workplace more appealing to workers. And that would include offering basic heat protection. So I think it could be beneficial to farmers as well to incentivize workers to work for them by making the workplace safe.
Before we talk about California, Gray, how are you hearing from any owners of farms in Florida or people who own construction firms? I mean, are the bosses saying, no matter what DeSantis says, we're still going to protect our workers?
You know, I think it's very patchwork. Yeah. I think it really, really depends on the individual farmer.
Right.
And certainly I think some farmers aren't going to protect their workers because we've seen even when there are protections in place, farmers will violate them. And there's limited enforcement. I think that's another concern with, you know, even if a heat standard on a federal level is passed, before a potential Trump presidency, then there's also the question of OSHA enforcement, because under Trump, OSHA enforcement was incredibly limited.
Right. Yeah, great points. That is Gray Moran. You can read their piece, Florida Banned Farm Worker Heat Protections, A Groundbreaking Partnership Offers a Solution. Find that at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about protections for workers. If you think about a farm worker or a construction worker, anyone who works outside and then also, of course, inside, and we'll talk about that later in the show, but if you're working in 112-degree heat, even 90 degrees is hot. How are you supposed to protect yourself if there are no regulations on the books? If you work outdoors or indoors where it's really hot, we would love to hear about what that experience is like. Does your employer offer protections? Does your city or your state? What are your thoughts on this? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. And then if you work with anyone who has health illnesses because of heat, we're definitely going to talk about what this does to the body. You can also give us a call or email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're also joined by Jeannie Kwong, a reporter with CalMatters. Jeannie, before we talk about what California is trying to do to protect workers indoors, can you tell us about protections outdoors? You report that California has had a heat illness prevention rule for outdoor workers since 2005, when it rushed regulations into place after deaths of four farm workers. So what is on the books in California, and how can we make sure these rules are being enforced?
Yeah, absolutely. California has considered heat regulations for decades. And it started off with a lot of workers across different industries rallying around this issue back as early as like the 80s and 90s, both indoors and outdoors workers. And then you know, certain industries, such as library workers in Los Angeles, like they didn't have air conditioning in the stacks. And, you know, these industries eventually did start adopting air conditioning. So then the issue was kind of before outdoor workers. And in 2004 and 2005, there were a few farm workers who died on the job in heat-related incidents. And so that year in 2005, the state rushed through these regulations and got them on the books. So California was the first state to have to have heat protections for workers on the books. The regulations kick in at, I believe it's 80 degrees. Outdoors workers have to be provided shade, breaks, water. And then for certain industries, such as agriculture and also construction workers, when it hits 95 degrees, there are even additional protections, kind of like mandated 10-minute breaks every 2 hours, you know, additional monitoring by your employer to kind of make sure that you're still doing okay, just things like that.
And how is that enforced?
It's enforced by California's OSHA division, and essentially, you know, if you think that that's being violated, you can make a complaint to Cal OSHA.
And you also bring up a really interesting issue that I think a lot of people, you know, might not really think about unless you're in the situation. When you think about indoor heat, the first thing I thought of was prisons, and you have a piece on that. But as you say, librarians who didn't have access to an air conditioner. So if you think of all these workers in California and across the country who work in these spaces without AC, they're also dealing with extreme heat. Do we have any idea just how many people are exposed to extreme heat inside who may not have access to air conditioning?
You know, I don't know that figure, but the major groups of workers that would be affected by indoor heat regulations, which are on the table right now but have not been officially adopted, we're talking largely about warehouse workers, certain manufacturing plants, and a lot of restaurant workers too, who, you know, there might not be air conditioning in the kitchen just because of the nature of the work. So the warehouse workers have been particularly vocal in pushing for protections to be extended to them as well, because a lot of warehouses, which as we all know, have experienced this huge boom during the pandemic and even before that in really hot parts of California, the Inland Empire, now Kern County is having a warehouse boom. You know, a lot of these warehouses don't have air conditioning. And so those are the workers that have been really pushing for protections.
Yeah, that's a really good one, because I remember when there were all the stories about what's going on at Amazon. I'm just looking up some headlines right here. The LA Times, September 2022, what is it like working at Amazon during a heat wave? Jacobin had a piece in August of last year, according to a worker-led study in the summer of 2022. An Amazon facility surpassed 80 degrees Fahrenheit and has reached 95 degrees in loading areas. So, Jeannie, can you talk about what is happening in California to protect workers indoors?
Yeah, California in 2016 passed a law directing the state's workplace safety agencies to adopt indoor heat protections. 2016 was a long time ago. They had set a deadline of 2019 to, you know, get these rules in place. That was 5 years ago. The proposed rule has undergone just like a very long, you know, somebody mentioned the long bureaucratic process it takes to get rules on the books. That's very much what happened here. It just underwent a lot of revisions. It had a very lengthy economic impact analysis process, which is required by the state for major regulations. And it is still basically being considered. It still hasn't been officially adopted. It was initially supposed to be voted on by the state's workplace standards board in March. But very last minute, odd thing happened. Other agencies at the state level, the Department of Finance, said, wait a second, we think that this is going to cost state prisons far more money than you initially estimated. And that kind of halted the whole thing for a bit. And so now we've kind of, you know, the workers' advocates were furious. You know, it's already 5 years late. So we're kind of in this waiting period right now where the state has agreed to exempt prisons for now from the indoor heat protections, bring it back to the standards board for a vote, potentially next month. And then it still has to go through some approval process before it's like officially on the books in effect. And so that's expected to happen later this summer. Worker advocates had really wanted it to happen by this month, just to be ready for the summer. I mean, it's May and it was already, you know, above 90 degrees earlier this month. I'm in Sacramento. So, you know, worker advocates feel that this was really, really urgent to get done this summer. It's looking like it's probably going to happen later this summer. And then they plan to introduce new regulations specifically for prisons, perhaps later this year. That process could, you know, obviously take another few months to several years.
Jeannie Kwong is a reporter with CalMatters, and you can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. You can also find Gray Moran's pieces about Florida. They're a reporter with Civil Eats. Carly Hyland is assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about the growing risk of heat illness to workers across the country, both outdoor and indoor. There are no federal protections on the books. We were just talking about what is on the books in states like California. And then just recently, Republican governors in Florida and Texas signed legislation to prevent cities like Dallas and Miami from taking action to regulate heat exposure. So what can workers do who have no choice but to protect themselves? After a break, we'll talk about what heat actually does to the body. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Yesterday, we talked about the connections between our food choices and the climate crisis, deforestation, species extinction, water scarcity. The list is long. We talked about the upcoming Compassionate Eating Conference. It's going to be happening on June 1st in Novato, California at 1 p.m. And our guest, Hope Bohanic, who's putting on the conference, has offered to give away a free pair of tickets. So if you would like to attend the Compassionate Eating Conference on June 1st at 1 p.m., the organizers will give you two tickets. So the first person who calls 866-798-8255 will get those tickets. Again, it's June 1st at 1 p.m. in Novato, the Compassionate Eating Conference. Thanks to Hope Bohanic for offering two tickets to the first caller, 866-798-8255. And if you'd like to join today's conversation about the growing risk of heat illness to workers across the country, if you work in a place indoors that is hot, we'd love to hear from you. And if you work outside, what is it like when it hits, you know, 85, 90, or even above 100? What is it like for you? Does your employer offer protections? We'd love to hear your story. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Gray Moran, a reporter with Civil Eats. Jeannie Kwan is a reporter with CalMatters. And Carly Hyland is assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Professor Hyland, we're learning so much more about how our bodies react to heat. Can you tell us more about that? What does heat do to our bodies?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of evidence. You know, my work is specifically really looking at farm workers, that heat can impact, you know, different cardiometabolic systems. And, you know, once your internal body temperature exceeds certain thresholds, your whole body systems kind of just start to break down. And then for farm workers and other workers, it can also cause more accidents. You know, a lot of these occupations are inherently really dangerous to begin with. And so it can cause, you know, impacts such as fatigue, you know, tiredness. And then there's often a lot more accidents following that. And that's where some of these, you know, heat-related mortality events have come from also, is directly from heat and then also indirectly with other accidents at the workplace.
And can you talk about, when you look at how heat affects the body, you mentioned this briefly earlier, but the importance of these breaks, especially for farm workers, the importance of shade, the importance of having access to clean drinking water.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's kind of different layers of protection that we think about for things like this. And so the easiest to implement are things like, you know, wearing a cooling bandana or, you know, kind of personal level behaviors, but really those are not addressing the root cause of heat stress and are really just placing the burden for protection on individual farm workers when really we need kind of more system-wide solutions. And one thing I'll note also is some work that I've done with farm workers has shown that some of these individual level interventions for decreasing heat stress are in, you know, direct conflict with other, you know, exposures that farm workers have. So for example, you know, we're really concerned about pesticide exposure among farm workers. And one of the big recommendations there is to wear, you know, long sleeves, long pants, a mask, gloves, et cetera. And I heard from farm workers directly that they felt suffocated when they would wear those materials and that they would be more likely to not wear those materials in order to avoid heat stress, even if it meant greater exposure or greater impacts from pesticides, just because heat often presents a more, you know, short-term acute impact. And so really in order to address this at a systemic level, we need, you know, workplace level interventions such as access to cold water, you know, electrolyte beverages, access to breaks in the shade. And I think this is where, when you get into the nuance of some of this, this is where it gets really, you know, interesting, in that in places like California, you know, the messaging is constantly water rest shade, but there's a lot of nuance within that, you know, like does a palm tree count as shade? Like, well, no, probably not really, because it's not actually providing shade for the whole crew. You know, how often do you need rest? How much rest do you need? Oftentimes, you know, workers are out in the field, and if they want to take a rest break, they have to walk 5+ minutes to get there. And by that time, you know, their break is almost over. And so they haven't actually really gotten any reprieve. Mm-hmm. And one thing I also really want to point out that I've heard in states like Idaho and California, is that farm workers often do not have consistent access to clean bathrooms, which is such an important part. You know, if you're telling farm workers to drink more water, but they don't want to use the bathrooms at the workplace because they're so unclean, you know, they're simply just not going to drink more water. And we've heard this directly from farm workers. And so I think we need kind of, you know, these solutions are not so complex. Like we know the answers to them, but we need to make sure that we're addressing interventions at a workplace level and not just placing the burden for protection on individual, you know, marginalized workers.
Is there any way of knowing how common it is for farm workers not to have access to clean bathrooms?
You know, unfortunately, we don't have great data on that. We, in work that I have done and other groups have done, we have heard directly from farm workers very consistently that they don't have access to clean bathrooms. Mm-hmm. I think the problem with, you know, so many of these things, whether it's bathroom or enforcement of heat regulations, et cetera, is that there is, in my opinion, not enough capacity at institutions like Cal OSHA to robustly conduct inspections. And so quite often, again, the burden is on individual farm workers to reach out if they think that there's a concern, and then Cal OSHA will come do an inspection. But, you know, there's so much fear and marginalization in this population already that many are very unwilling or unlikely to reach out and ask for an inspection.
Wow. And it's just really, what word do we even use? It's shameful. I mean, to think about farm workers picking strawberries, it's such hard work, and they're thirsty in 100 degree heat, but they don't want to drink because they don't want to go to the bathroom. I mean, what a twisted situation, Professor Hyland. I mean, what is it going to take, do you think, to change this?
You know, that's such a good question. That's exactly what I'm trying to figure out in my work. And I really think we need to find a place where different groups and different stakeholders can come together at the table and talk about how can we start implementing these solutions. Again, we know the answers to a lot of these things. It's not like we necessarily, in my opinion, need a lot of research trying to figure out what the solutions are. But in my opinion, it's more, how do we implement these and then get feedback from farm workers to make sure, you know, that we're implementing them in the right way, if we need to make any tweaks to make sure that it's being as effective as possible. So that's kind of the approach I'm taking, is trying to engage with different groups, including employers, farm workers, community groups, farm worker advocates, et cetera, to just start conversations about, okay, what will it take? Like, how can we start implementing these? Because I think sometimes the conversation gets focused on, oh, this is going to be, you know, such a huge issue in the coming years with increasing climate change. And we're already there. Like, we are behind the eight ball and already in terms of protecting workers, and it's only going to continue to get worse.
Right. And that's why I express just so much frustration, because we've been doing shows about this for years, talking about especially what's happening with farm workers. And while there have been small victories here and there, I mean, to think that right now, I mean, let's think about a woman who is working in the fields and it's so hot and she doesn't want to go to the bathroom because the bathroom is disgusting. I mean, it's just, you just have to wonder, what is it going to take? So we just got an email from a listener who said, you know, where are the religious leaders? What are they doing to save human life here? What are they doing to demand water for these workers? Frank writes in, the retail apparel industry solved sweatshop conditions through publicizing the names of the brands using sweatshops. Public economic boycotts are powerful. Orange juice? And he's referring to, you know, people working in the orange fields in Florida. So can you talk about the activism that is happening and what works? Because we have seen some changes. So Gray, again, you've done a lot of work in Florida. What can you tell us about the on-the-ground activism that is happening to change the situation? And what are people doing, given that DeSantis just signed this bill saying, you know, sorry, Miami, you can't pass a law to protect workers from heat?
Yeah. And I really appreciate the comment from the listener about the effectiveness of boycotts of, say, orange juice, because I do often feel like the conversation is sometimes limited to farm owners and farm workers, and they're often, you know, pitted against each other, where farm owners will say that they can't afford to expand labor protections. But I think it's also important to recognize that they're selling to retailers that are major corporations that are significantly wealthier than the suppliers. And they also could play a role in cleaning up their supply chains and ensuring that their supply chains are ethical, starting at the base. And that's what we've seen some farm workers and farm worker advocates doing in Florida with the Coalition of Immokalee Workers that developed the Fair Food Program. And that program, I think, was so successful because it was also able to engage retailers. So in that partnership, the retailers prioritize the farmers who implement these worker protections. And so it benefits the farmers, it benefits the farm workers, and then it benefits the retailers because they're able to have the assurance that their supply chain is more ethical than other farms. And often retailers just aren't aware, they're not on the ground, they're not seeing what is happening on the farms that supply their products. So that's been a very good development in Florida that started off in tomato fields there and has since expanded to other states. There's a similar program in the dairy industry in Vermont. So I think that's a very promising solution. But we're also seeing the real impacts of at least Florida's anti-immigration law that was passed in 2022, where farm worker advocates that I've interviewed have also described how farm workers are scared now to report violations. And just so concerned about their own livelihoods that they're not reporting workplace hazards.
Right, because they're undocumented and they're fearful of what's going to happen. And to think about, you know, if Trump gets back into office, he's talking about mass migration policy. I mean, I'm sorry, mass deportation policies.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the law that Florida passed last year, SB 1718, I think that, you know, could be thought of as a kind of a preview of what could come on a national scale. But I also think it's important to note that that law also wasn't in the economic interests of Florida, because Florida is highly dependent on farm workers. And we saw farm workers leaving the state. One component of that law is it required E-Verify to be mandated on farms. But that component of the law has yet to go into effect. So that's going to be go into effect next month. So we'll see what happens.
And one more question, Gray, since you've reported on the Fair Food Program, again, this is a partnership, as you report, between retailers, farmers, and farm workers. They've implemented the strongest legally binding heat protocols in the nation on Florida's farms while bypassing the state's Republican-controlled legislature. What will happen to this program now that DeSantis has passed this anti-worker protection law into place?
Yeah, to my knowledge, it can, it still bypasses the new law because the new law is only targeting municipalities. And these protections are based on a contract.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information. Jeannie, what would you add? You know, what is happening in California? What really works when it comes to organizing to make these important changes?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing I would say is that a lot of labor enforcement in California depends on this network of very small, very grassroots worker centers, worker advocacy groups who, you know, build relationships with workers, speak their language, and become people that workers trust. You know, many workers, as we've discussed, don't trust the government, don't even know where to go report a violation, but they might, you know, be open to talking with an organizer or an advocate at the ground level who knows the industry, knows which contractors are operating where, and you know, are kind of there to guide a worker through the investigative process, like through the process of making a complaint,
and just kind of act as their advocate through that. And so I think that is an important part of the process that might help make it easier for the state to be opening investigations and actually enforcing these rules. I know there's been some efforts to expand these partnerships between the state and these types of organizations. So that's something that I think is worth thinking about as a solution.
And what are your thoughts, Professor Hyland, about where this goes from here? Given that so many groups are working on these issues, you've got in some Texas and Florida, cities passing much needed protections, and then the governors saying, nope, we're not going to implement those. So as you say, there's a patchwork across the country, but federal legislation, it might not be enforced. So where are we right now? And where do you see us going, given that to think that we've got 112 degree weather, this is Miami's heat index last Saturday, and then Key West hitting 115. I mean, I don't think I've ever experienced that kind of heat. That's really hot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that Gray and Jeannie both pointed out really great examples of groups not waiting on states or federal governments to pass regulations and building upon the energy of workers to collaborate and develop programs to protect individuals. And so I think that's really where my energy is focused right now, is trying to engage different groups in developing effective solutions and then trying to, spread that and scale that up and encourage other, farm employers and other groups to adopt those protections. But I think, to your point earlier, I think you said something along the lines of it could take 3 to 8 years for a federal, OSHA standard to be passed. And of course, there's just so much uncertainty, and that could go in vastly different directions depending on how the election goes. And so I think that we really need to capitalize on all of this energy and momentum from workers, from worker groups, and like Jeannie pointed out, these trusted groups in different states, and work together to develop solutions that really protect workers.
Professor Hyland, what happens when these issues get major media attention? I've been thinking a lot about the videos of UPS drivers that have gone viral on social media. For example, a lot of people have cameras now on their front doors, and so they've got videos of these drivers who drop off the packages and then faint. And in the worst case scenario, you've got drivers who have died. I'm just reading right now from a CBS piece last August. A Texas UPS driver fell ill while working during a scorching heat wave and later died. Christopher Begley, 57, died shortly after becoming sick earlier this month, last August, while on his route in North Texas, where the high temperature at the time topped 100. So what are your thoughts about, I hate to say this, but it's like, this is what we need more of, this media coverage and these viral videos, because I'm sure a lot of people would be shocked to learn that these workers do not have protections. And so the media plays a really important role here.
Absolutely. I agree with that so much. And that's why, I get so excited when groups like yourself are covering this and trying to increase attention on it. And I think I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. I think farm workers are such an invisible population. They're often working in pretty rural areas. Many people in the United States and across the world don't know a whole lot about where their food comes from and the conditions of those working to produce their food. And so I have been thinking a lot about how do we get the public more aware and more engaged, not just about heat, but about, an array of issues facing, workers who produce our food for us. I don't, have an answer to that yet, but it's something I'm thinking about a lot, because I do think that people would be astonished to hear about a lot of these conditions. And to Gray's point earlier, it's a whole food systems process, and there needs to be accountability in all processes, from the farm to the table, and making sure that workers are receiving basic rights. And there have been some models of that that have started to be developed. You know, there's a program called the Equitable Food Initiative that provides another label that's on food. It's sort of like the organic label. You know, previous work that I've done looking at like organic versus conventional diets shows that Americans don't really necessarily trust those labels or don't always understand what they mean. And so I think there are some models by which we can, you know, really highlight farms that are implementing good practices and try and increase pressure for, you know, different grocery markets and other parts of the food system to purchase from farms that are protecting their workers. But I think we do still have a long way to go to achieving that.
And Frank's email about boycotts, I think, is so important. Just to let people know, what does UPS do to protect their workers? What does Amazon do or does not do? I mean, we see these UPS trucks and Amazon trucks every day, no matter where we live. So to name that. And then, you know, many people, unless you're buying a brand of a strawberry, for example, you pick up strawberries from the store and maybe the store lists the farm, maybe it doesn't. So I think that it'd be also helpful to let, because people do care about these issues. Nobody wants to buy from a company who's treating, well, I shouldn't say nobody, but people don't want to buy from companies who treat their workers horribly. So to raise more awareness about what companies are doing the right thing and what companies are not is also really important. We're almost out of time, Professor Hyland.
Yeah, I agree with everything that you've said, and it's a complex system. Like you said, you don't know when you go to the grocery store exactly where your food came from, and trying to have a little bit more transparency there and, you know, incentivizing employers to implement better health protective practices, and then, you know, trying to encourage folks to buy from those farms. I think, like I said, a lot of work to be done, but I think there is a lot of energy and momentum in this area.
Yes, and we have to continue talking about these issues. Carly Hyland is assistant professor at UC Berkeley School of Public Health. Jeannie Kwong is a reporter with CalMatters, and Gray Moran is a reporter with Civil Eats. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Great
to be here. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.